This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Today we're focusing on new information and analysis about communism and McCarthyism in America. Much of the new information comes from Soviet archives, which were opened after the fall of communism. Our first guest, Harvey Clare, has made two trips to Moscow and has read the released documents of the Communist International, or Comintern, which supervised activities of communist parties around the world. He says these documents show that the American Party was heavily funded and controlled by the Soviets. Clare is the co-author of the new book, The Soviet World of American Communism, which is part of the Yale University Press Annals of Communism series. Clare is a professor at Emory University. I asked him why he thinks the subject of his new book, Soviet Control Over the American Communist Party, is so important.
Well, it's been a very contentious issue over the years, from really the origins of the American Communist Party. Back in 1919, there were Americans who claimed that it was controlled by the Soviet Union, that it was not a really American organization. In the 1930s, when the Communist Party for the first time in this country began to grow in strength, critics attacked the party because of its Soviet connections. And perhaps even more importantly, in terms of the controversy that the Communist Party engendered in this country, critics, particularly from the right, often attacked the New Deal and Franklin Roosevelt because of their supposed connections with communism and the Communist Party. And then during the McCarthy period in the 1940s and early 1950s in the United States, when the issue of communist subversion, domestic communism, became one of the primary political issues in the United States, the whole question of whether the American Communist Party was connected to the Soviet Union was a subject of enormous controversy and caused a lot of careers and lives to go on the line.
Now, you say in your new book that the American Communist Party was never an independent political organization. It never made decisions autonomously. Give us the big picture based on the documents you found in the Soviet archives, the big picture of how much control the Soviet Communist Party exerted over the American Communist Party.
Well, the control, in a sense, really began almost from the moment that the American Communist Party was created. Actually, in 1919, when American communism came into existence, two communist parties were formed in this country. And immediately, both of those communist parties sent delegates to Moscow to get approval and recognition from the Soviet Union. It was as if the Soviet Union owned the franchise, and here you had two potential local franchisees running for an imprimatur. And from that very moment on, the American Communist Party had the habit of looking to Moscow for decisions to resolve their disputes when they could not agree on an issue, and for money. Again, from the very beginning of its existence, the Communist Party received enormous amounts of financing from the Soviet Union.
You say that the Soviet funding enabled the Communist Party in the United States to pay organizers, to publish newspapers, support a variety of educational and union activities, and it enabled the American Communist Party to create an infrastructure greater than it could have supported through membership dues and contributions of party members. How much money would you say the Soviets typically contributed per year to the American Communist Party? I know this all depends on inflation and all of that.
Right.
But just give us a sense.
Well, it varied enormously over the years. One of the documents that we found that was actually reproduced in a previous book that we published called The Secret World of American Communism indicated that in 1919, when John Reed, who was the journalist, the hero of the Warren Beatty movie Reds, and one of the founders of the American Communist Movement, John Reed was sent to Moscow. He was one of the delegates from one of these competing communist parties seeking recognition. He was given more than $1 million worth of gold and jewels to bring back to the United States to help establish the young American communist movement. That initial down payment was a one-time fee. But in the 1920s, for example, the Soviet Union and the Comintern would provide in a given year $50,000, $60,000, $70,000 to the American Party. It's sometimes hard to figure out exactly how much money they were given in a particular year because there were often special subventions. For example, the budget of the party in a given year might be $25,000 or $30,000, but then there would be a special appropriation to support the Daily Worker, the party newspaper. Or another $5,000 or $10,000 would be sent to finance a meeting of the party's organization for Black Americans. There were a lot of different sources of money to different parts of the party. We estimate in the book that in the 1920s, the Soviet Union and the Comintern were providing somewhere between one-third and two-thirds of the party's annual budget.
Now, you said that the party saw nothing wrong with accepting money from the Soviets. On the other hand, the American Party didn't want anyone to know that they were taking this money. I guess the reasons why are obvious, but why don't you address them anyways and tell us how the American Party covered up the money that it was getting?
Right. Well, obviously the party had several reasons for not letting people know that the Soviets were funding them. First of all, it was illegal. This was money that was being brought into the country illegally, smuggled in. Secondly, the party was concerned that it would be tarred as a Soviet tool if people knew that the Soviet Union was paying the party budget. And actually, the party may have had another reason for hiding the money. If people knew that they were getting all this Moscow gold, as it was sometimes derisively referred to, it would have been harder to raise money in this country, as people would be more reluctant to give money to the party, saying, why don't you just get it from Moscow? So the party had a number of reasons for concealing it. The most important one, clearly, was the fact that it would have been used by the party's enemies. And so they took a number of different measures to get the money in. In the 1920s, it was often brought in by couriers. Seamen often would carry money or jewels between Moscow and the United States. There's considerable evidence that we present in the book that beginning in the 1950s, the KGB agents brought the money in, often Soviet diplomats, brought the money into the United States and then gave it to emissaries of the party. And in this period of time, the amounts were really staggering. We found some receipts, which are reprinted in the book, for example, that in the 1980s, the Soviet Communist Party, there was no more Comintern by this time, the Soviet Communist Party was providing the American Communist Party $2 to $3 million a year.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Harvey Clare, and he's co-author of the new book, The Soviet World of American Communism. And it's about the Soviet influence on the Communist Party, and it's based on recently released documents from the Soviet archives. You say that one of the most telling illustrations of the American Communist Party's loyalty to Stalin is this, their reaction to the non-aggression treaty between Nazi Germany and the Soviet Union, which was signed in August of 1939. First of all, just refresh everybody's memory about what this agreement was.
Well, the Soviet Union and the American Communist Party had been staunch anti-fascists, and then in the August of 1939, the Soviet Union and Nazi Germany completed a non-aggression pact, which opened the way for the German invasion of Poland, the beginning of World War II, the Soviet seizure of the Baltic nations and part of Eastern Poland, and really the outbreak of the Second World War.
Now, the American Communist Party never challenged the Soviets when they signed this pact with Hitler.
That's right. The American Party, which had been staunchly pro-collective security and anti-Nazi, was confused for a couple of days. The party didn't know quite what to make of this pact. But then Earl Browder, the party leader, received a shortwave radio transmission from Moscow ordering him to switch gears, to attack the Roosevelt administration, telling him that the Second World War was now a war that between Nazi Germany and on one side and Britain and France on the other side, in which both sides were equally culpable. It was an imperialist war, and American communists really shouldn't care who won.
In fact, let me quote a little bit from a memo from the Soviets to the American party. At issue here is not only fascism, but the very existence of the entire capitalist system. The issue of fascism is secondary. The main and fundamental issue is the struggle against capitalism, against bourgeois dictatorship. So they're saying, you know, well, it's really not about fascism here.
Right. If fascism, in the words, I think it was Molotov who said, fascism is a matter of taste. He was the Soviet foreign minister. Well, for several years, communists had been screaming about fascism, and now suddenly they had discovered that, well, fascism was really not an issue at all. One couldn't tell the difference between Nazi Germany and Democratic Britain and Democratic France, and Democratic America, for that matter.
Well, how did the party line change after the Nazi invasion of the Soviet Union?
Well, it changed dramatically and very, very quickly. The day before the invasion, the American Party, one of its front groups, had been sponsoring demonstrations outside the White House, opposing aid to Great Britain, opposing American intervention in any way, shape, or form. After the Nazi invasion of the Soviet Union, the American Party received frantic cables and shortwave radio transmissions from Moscow ordering them to change their position immediately, which they did. Instead of saying, stay out of the European war, the new slogan was all-out aid to the Allies. And the American Communist Party immediately began agitating for full American support for Britain, France, and the Soviet Union. And, of course, the American Party was delighted when America entered World War II after Pearl Harbor.
My guest is Harvey Clare, co-author of the new book, The Soviet World of American Communism. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Harvey Clare, co-author of the new book, The Soviet World of American Communism, about Soviet control over the American Communist Party. It's based on documents from recently opened Soviet archives. Another example you give about how the American Communist Party towed the line of the Soviet Party was during the purges, the Stalinist purges, which the American Party didn't officially object to. You tell a new story within that larger story about a group of American and Canadian Finns who had settled in the Karelian region of the USSR, which bordered on Finland. Tell us the story of these people.
Well, I think that's one of the most tragic stories in the book. Finns were one of the largest ethnic groups represented in the American Communist Party. In the 1920s, perhaps half of the Communist Party was composed of Finnish Americans. Even later on, as other ethnic groups became more prominent in the party, there were still large numbers of Finns. Indeed, Gus Hall, the current head of the American Communist Party, is Finnish, Finnish American. In the late 1920s and early 1930s, there developed in the United States and Canada among Finnish Americans and Finnish Canadians what was called Karelian fever. Karelia was a region of the Soviet Union adjacent to Finland, whose inhabitants were of Finnish descent and spoke a Finnish dialect. And thousands of Finns from the United States and Canada were recruited to go to Karelia to help build socialism there. The party supported this, provided money, and as I say, several thousand people went. In the mid-1930s, these people got caught up in the purges, and thousands of them were arrested. Virtually all the adult males were arrested, charged with being traitors, counter-revolutionaries, Trotskyites, wreckers, and so on, and sent to the Gulag, where most of them were murdered. The American Communist Party had to have known that these charges were false. Many of the people that were arrested had been leaders in the Finnish communist movement in this country. The American Party piled on. They endorsed the Soviet charges. They accused these people that had been arrested of being traitors. A handful of families managed to come back from Karelia to the United States, and they were attacked here. The party denounced them as traitors, warned them not to make a stink about what had happened. Altogether, it was an extraordinarily horrible episode, and it's one that really has not been written about very much by American historians, even though, as I say, several thousand Americans and their families were caught up in the Gulag and in the Soviet purges.
The American Communist Party didn't protest the purges while they were happening. What happened in 1956 after Khrushchev condemned the purges?
Well, that was really one of the things that helped destroy the communist movement in the United States. When the leader of the Soviet Union announced that Stalin had committed mass murder and that many of the people who had been killed or sent to the Gulag were innocent, American communists suddenly were forced to accept the fact that it was the truth, even though most Americans had long known about this. But it was devastating to American communists. There were a lot of nervous breakdowns. People quit the movement. People felt betrayed. They felt that their lives had been based on a lie. The American Party split apart. There were a couple of other issues involved, but the revelations of the purges were certainly one of the major factors in destroying what was left of the American communist movement in the mid-1950s.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Harvey Clare. He's co-author of the new book, The Soviet World of American Communism, and it's about Soviet control of the American Communist Party, and it's based on recently released documents in Soviet archives. You say in your book that many leftists are unwilling to acknowledge that an organization, the Communist Party, that seemed to speak for the disenfranchised and argued for equality was actually tied to a foreign power, and that the American Communist Party can neither choose its own leaders nor set its own agenda. Do you want to elaborate on your thoughts on that?
Well, there's been over the past decade or two, a fierce debate among American historians who study American communism and the American left about the nature of the party. And on the one hand, there are people that I suppose have the same interpretation that John Haynes, my co-author, and I do share, which is that the party really was a creature of the Soviet Union. And on the other hand, a group of historians who, many of whom came out of the New Left, who saw in the party an authentic, homegrown American radicalism and believed that were it not for McCarthyism and the McCarthy era, that there would not have been the disjunction between the old left of the Communist Party in the 1930s and sort of the new left of the 1960s, that McCarthyism had destroyed this essential continuity in the American left. I think that the documents that we uncovered in Moscow make it very, very clear that the American Party was never independent. Lots of people joined the Communist Party for very noble kinds of motives, and the party certainly was involved in many activities and campaigns that promoted worthwhile causes. But the party did not do that on its own. It did not do that out of its own volition, out of some kind of internal thrust. It did it because of what was going on in the Soviet Union and what its Soviet overlords was telling it to do.
A little later in our program, we're going to be hearing from Ellen Schrecker, who's the author of a new book on McCarthyism in America called Many Are the Crimes. I'd like to have you share your impressions of her book, if you would.
Ellen Schrecker has done a prodigious amount of research and has a lot of very interesting information in her new book. I disagree with her evaluation and interpretation of the American Communist movement, however. She says that the American Communist Party was both a tool of the Soviet Union and an independent Native American movement. I don't think that an organization can be both those sorts of things. certainly most of the members of the American Communist Party thought of themselves as independent, but the party itself was a very hierarchical organization whose leadership very, very closely controlled the campaigns and the activities that the members embarked on. And I think that she vastly underestimates the extent to which its fealty to the Soviet Union colored its activities and colored the responses of most Americans to it. I don't think it's any accident that the McCarthy phenomenon was at its most virulent in a period when the United States was fighting a hot war in Korea against two communist powers. And many Americans were literally enraged that some of their fellow citizens would be supporting communist regimes against which Americans were fighting and dying.
Well, needless to say, we'll ask her impressions of your book. I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
It's been a pleasure.
Harvey Clare is the co-author of The Soviet World of American Communism. He's a professor at Emory University. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.